attention. As the court is now sitting, God save the United States and this honorable court.
A very good morning to everyone. The first order of business this morning is a motion for admission to the bar, and I have the honor of making the motion before my colleagues. Would Adriana Kostanek please come to the podium? Judge Cudahy, Judge Wood, I have the honor of moving the admission this morning of my law clerk, Adriana Kostanek. Ms. Kostanek is a member of the bar of the state of Illinois. She is a graduate of Northwestern University, undergraduate. She received a Bachelor of Arts in American Studies, and she is also a graduate of Northwestern University's Law School, where she was a member of the Law Review. She's served the court with distinction throughout this year and will be leaving us now to go to work for Mayor Brown and Rowan Moore, and I'm very pleased to move her admission to the bar of this court.
Well, speaking, I think, for myself, and I expect for Judge Cuddy as well, though he will say something, we're very pleased to grant this motion and welcome you to the bar of our court.
Yeah, likewise, and very little I can add to that, I think, but certainly I'm highly qualified, and we're pleased to have you join us.
And if you will walk to the clerk's desk, the oath will be administered. Our first case this morning is number 054171, Disability Rights of Wisconsin Incorporated against the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Mr. Spitzer-Resnick.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and the panel. This is, at one level, a relatively simple case. The agency I work for and represent, Disability Rights Wisconsin, which during briefing was known as Wisconsin Coalition for Advocacy, sought what is otherwise confidential information from the Department of Public Instruction. Why did we do that? We did that for two reasons. One, there was very credible evidence, it has not been challenged, that there was probable abuse and or neglect of children, disabled children, in an elementary school in Monroe, Wisconsin. They were kept in a darkened, locked seclusion room for undetermined amounts of time. And in our investigation, we were originally only able to find the name of one of these students. After this became a newsworthy event, and there was television investigation, the Department of Public Instruction decided to do its own investigation. And at a certain point, shortly thereafter, we received a copy of the investigation findings, which did not name any students, but said in the findings that there were six students in the past year that had been locked in that room. We determined then that pursuant to the Protection and Advocacy Acts, and there are three of them, they've been explained in the brief, so I won't detail that, we had the authority and are actually the responsibility to investigate under federal law this allegation of abuse and neglect of these children. So we sought.
Mr. Spitzer-Resnick, yes. One thing that it would help me if we could clarify here, since I had the sense that the briefs were a bit ships passing in the night on some of these issues, is the precise extent of your request, or maybe you could tell me how it sort of worked as your most preferred outcome or alternatives, because your brief, or both of your briefs, repeatedly say that you wanted the full investigation report, including notes, in the unredacted form, but that you also had said in the alternative that you wanted the parents of the six, or the legal guardians, whoever they were, of the six children whose names you had no way of knowing, to receive those reports. So if the parents had gotten the reports, is it your assumption that they would have then been entitled to seek your assistance or not as they saw fit?
Well, there's a few questions there, so I'll try to break them down. First of all, the reason we went and explained about the issue of notifying the parents is to illustrate a number of things. First of all, there's an argument that's been made, although we do not accept it, that under the PAMI Act, one of the three acts, we were required to exhaust administrative remedies. There are, of course, no administrative remedies mentioned in any of the laws that are specific, but to show that we were not simply looking for a lawsuit here, we explained that we attempted, administratively, if you will, to provide with DPI with other reasonable alternatives. The alternative in the first place being notify the parents of your findings so that they know what happened to their children. DPI, to this day, has refused to do that. So one issue is, to the extent that there's an exhaustion argument, we don't believe there is, we have exhausted to the extent that we felt it was reasonable to do so. A secondary factor is another reason for what we believe is a very strong deference to protection and advocacy agencies to get these records and to have the authority to determine what is probable cause for getting the records is that we're looking at people, in this case children with disabilities, some nonverbal, some with limited verbal capacities, who cannot be assumed to be able to figure out, A, that their rights were violated, and B, where to go to get those rights redressed. Had DPI proffered the material, the investigative findings, to the parents, at least an argument could have been made, which cannot be made now. Well, no, we notified these parents. They did know. Now, those findings did not alert them to the existence of the Protection and Advocacy Agency, so I'm not sure it would have been complete. The fact is, the facts before the court don't raise the specific issue, would it have been enough? I think that the facts are, it would have been enough for us as a factual matter because we probably would have chosen not to bring the lawsuit because, frankly, we've got a lot better things to do than simply sue over things like this, over to clarify points of law. That was not our purpose here. However, we also have a responsibility, if you will, and this is a perfect case for this, to not only investigate the underlying facts, but to investigate the investigation. And that's one of the reasons why we asked for the notes as well as the names that were contained within the file. We have always maintained that we wanted the entire file. We didn't say the entire report. We said the entire file. And of course, when you make such a request in litigation, you don't know what's in the file. You just have to make the broad request. And why did we do that? Because, among other things, we found out, not with any help of the Department of Public Instruction, that many children were locked up in this room further back than a year. Why did DPI only investigate 1 year? It's not a statute of limitations issue. We don't know that. There are other affected children beyond the five that are, you know, at stake, if you will, in the redacted names. Now, DPI wouldn't have found that out, but upon discovering that kind of information, we could have talked to a total of six parents and, have you heard of anybody else? Do you know who else was in this class? Did anybody talk to you? All the kinds of things normal investigators would have done. That was not able to happen in this case.
Could I ask you another sort of general question?
Sure.
The Amicus National Disability Rights Network brief draws a distinction between individual records of a particular student, you know, Joe Smith, and investigative reports. Is that a distinction that you rely on, or how does that fit in, if at all, to your argument?
Well, it makes a difference here for a number of reasons. One, the pure facts of the situation. This is not a case against the school district seeking these children's records. We could have done that. We have done that in some instances. It's simply not before the court.
But so the children's records, I take it, you envision of is a file that says, you know, this child had a certain IEP or this child,
right,
you know, has so and so grades. Those are not the records,
right,
you're looking for.
Right. The other reason it's legally relevant is because there are other provisions of the Protection and Advocacy Acts that talk not about the individual's records, but about investigative records. And that's what we're seeking.
Okay.
And there's actually a lower standard, frankly, for obtaining investigative records. Now, the department has argued that we're not entitled to investigative records because they're not an agency charged with investigating abuse and neglect. Well, I find that a spacious argument. If they're not charged with investigating abuse and neglect, what were they doing? Now, they may argue, well, we're charged with investigating violations of the IDEA. Okay, they did that, but guess what? They also cited violations of state building codes. They're not charged with doing that. And why was state building codes invoked here? Because you can't lock anybody, let alone a disabled child, in a room. It's a violation of fire codes. These kids could have died if a fire had happened in the building and nobody could get into the room, and the children certainly couldn't have gotten out, disability or no disability. So to say that they're not charged with investigating abuse and neglect, frankly, is ridiculous. And it's a denigration of their own authority. And I think, frankly, only made to try to get out from under the Protection and Advocacy Act, giving us the ability to get those records.
This is a follow-on, I think, to what Judge Wood was asking. She referred to individual records versus investigatory information. And there's a third category, directory information, which is bandied about in the in this debate over what, how do we characterize what you ask for? And it seems to me that the legal consequences pretty much flow from which one of those categories we're talking about.
They may, Your Honor, and to the extent that they do, that relates to the FERPA arguments that have been brought up by the Department of Public Instruction, and that's where directory information is discussed. The reason I say they may is, frankly, nobody other than the Department of Public Instruction, including the district court, had taken the time to even review in camera the notes. Nobody knows what's in there. They may be purely directory information, but I doubt it, Your Honor. As to the individual names in the investigative report, those certainly are simply directory information. And that's important under FERPA because directory information is, frankly, exempt from the FERPA normal disallowance, if you will, of giving out student information. And there's cases that have been cited that you can get students even addresses and phone numbers. That's directory information. And there's even a process, it's not been in the briefs, but it's in the regulations where parents can opt out of that. If you have children in school, you may have received one of those forms at the beginning of the year, say, I don't want my directory information published. But that's not as to a specific instance. It's a general thing. Just don't give it out generally. And there's been no allegation in this case that any of these parents said, I don't want directory information given out. Now, I think it's also important to understand, actually, I noticed my rebuttal time is up, so I think I'll sit down now and allow TPI to go.
We'll hear now from Mr. Blavia.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Tom Bellavia, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. I'd like to depart from my script right at the outset here to address some of the questions that have already come up, and in particular questions about the extent of what's been requested, the scope of what's really been requested in this case and how it was requested, and what the actual records are that are at issue here. Initially, DPI disclosed to DRW what was requested was their investigative file. They gave them a copy of the investigative file from which names had been redacted. And sent a letter to a letter explaining that that investigative file had been redacted, and that the notes of the personal notes of the individual investigators had not been included because they didn't consider personal notes to constitute part of the file. So that was known from the outset to DRW. The complaint requested an unredacted version of the investigative file. The investigative file was in the circuit court record in its redacted form. It's 104 pages in length.
But I mean, I think we're all on the same page so far about that. But I think the concern of DRW and the broader concern under the protection advocacy statutes precisely gets to the directory information, if you will, to the names of the children. And what bothers me about the state's position, I don't know under what authority you refuse to give at least the parents the relevant information. I'm not aware of any law that says parents are not entitled to know if their child has been put in a seclusion room, for example. Well, surely the state is not asserting a right as against the parents.
No, and there's not. And if parents request, there's.
But you see, they're requesting on behalf of the parents, and that's why I don't understand why you can say no, we're not going to give the parents this information.
Well, it's not the case that parents have received no information. The department instructed the school district in its letter concluding its investigation to conduct new IEP team meetings.
But that's different. I mean, if the parents were given this I don't know why the parents couldn't be given the investigative report. That could be very relevant. Sitting down for a new IEP meeting is one thing, where you're trying to figure out how many hours of speech therapy does this kid need, or how many
these
hours
IEP
of physical.
IEP meetings were specifically directed at the abuse issues with those children.
Well,
and follow-up conversations were conducted with the parents about the use of seclusion, with the seclusion issues with those children, excuse me, about those issues with the parents, both by the school district and by DPI.
But it still seems to me you are maintaining the right to control the information that's fed to the parents. You don't want the parents to read this investigative report.
DPI
and that seems to me not consistent with the parents' rights.
The investigative report is a matter of public record. It's been fully reported on in the newspaper the day that it was issued. It hasn't been kept secret. My client has resisted the demand from DRW that it can instruct DPI to send copies of that specific letter to those parents.
Why?
That at the time at which that request was made, it was because that was during the IEP team meetings, and DPI did not want to intervene in the relationship between the parents and the school at that point in
time.
Yeah,
see,
that's
problematic, frankly. I mean, that's one of the things that's problematic. Another thing maybe you could address is the distinction between the individual records and the investigative reports, which seems to be an important distinction here.
Yes, the investigative report is one of the things I wanted to get to, because there is per se no report. There was not a comprehensive report of an investigation created by DPI. There was a letter, which I think is about 6 pages long, from DPI to the superintendent of the school district summarizing the findings. That is the most analogous thing to an investigative report that exists, and it is completely unredacted and is contained in...
But what's this 100 pages you just mentioned?
That is a file of various documents that were accumulated by DPI in the course of their investigation. Now, only 9 pages of that file contain any redactions, and 6 of those 9 pages, what is redacted, is related to students who have subsequently provided consent, and all of that information has been given to DRW. There is actually only one page. There is one name redacted from one page in that 104 pages of a student who was not who was put in the room in question. That's the only information that's directly related that's been withheld from that 104 from that 104 pages.
I mean, I guess they have to take your word for that, right? Since you're not actually showing them the unredacted files and notes.
Well, you can tell from looking at what is and isn't there. With the notes, I cannot deny that statement. But an examination of that 104 pages reveals that there isn't individual student information about anybody else in there. You can see what's there, and by inference, you can tell that there's not
There's another dimension to this. Judge Crabb, in her opinion, did not mention these district court opinions from Hartford, Connecticut, and Michigan, which at least suggested coming out the other way, and based in part, I think, as I read it anyway, that the WCA is subject to a mandate of confidentiality under the law. So your disclosure here is to another agency which is required to keep the information confidential. What's your view of that rationale?
Well, I think there are two questions there. So far as those district court decisions are concerned, Judge Crabb's decision was based on a close examination of the language of the particular statutory provision under which DRW or WCA is claiming these records. These are students whose legal interests are represented by their parents.
But that's precisely what they're saying they aren't going under. That's the individual records section of the statute, isn't it?
And, no, I think that is a confusion in the amicus brief. This distinction between individual records and investigatory records. I'm unable to find anything in either pay me or in either of the protection and advocacy statutes there's nothing that defines individual records. The comprehensive statute relating to records, the two sections in each of those statutes relating to records, deal generally with individual records. Investigatory records are defined in the regulations as an example of one of the things that's not excluded from what can be obtained. But there is no definition anywhere in the statutes or in the regulations, to my knowledge, that says specifically what individual records are and that they are categorically distinct from investigatory records. As I read it, investigatory records that pertain to individuals are individual records like any other individual records. And the only statute that gives guidelines for providing access to records is the one that deals with individual records and provides those three categories of individuals.
But I looked at the implementing regulations here, and there were implementing regulations that specifically say if you're trying to get the investigatory reports. And, you know, surely these P&A acts mean something. Congress wouldn't have enacted them if they didn't want this type of agency to be part of the general system. They are entitled to get these investigative reports, which strike me as different from the individual records, even if the name of an individual is mentioned.
Well, once again, to the extent that there is an investigatory report here to which those regulations would apply, it's the letter that DPI produced.
Why is it only the letter and not the file?
The investigation. The file is not a report. It's not the work of DPI. It's a conglomeration of various materials, correspondence, things that were accumulated. It's not report. To me, suggests that it is the report that is produced as a result of the. As the result of the investigation.
Actually, I'm not sure that the regulations are limited to reports, but your time is running out. Let me just quickly ask you about exhaustion. What exactly is it that you think, in a perfect world, DRW would have done in order to exhaust?
The exhaustion issue was not one that I raised. It was raised by the district court.
But you're defending it.
As I understood the district court's position, they raised it as a pleading failure, not as an actual exhaustion failure.
When is exhaustion part of an affirmative case of a plaintiff? Nowhere that I can think of. Not in the PLRA, not in the Clean Air Act, not in anywhere that I can think of.
That was how I read what the district court
So you're
said.
Abandoning
and if it is simply a question as to whether this agency exhausted what was available to them, I think they actually did do what they could do under the circumstances, given that DPI has no formal procedures.
All right. So
for this,
exhaustion,
and that's why
we
I never
can consider
raised
that
the
that's
issue.
Off the table.
Okay.
All right.
Now I do want to address this question of individualized probable cause that I think was at the heart of the district court decision. The district court read the statute as requiring disclosure of these records only where the P&A agency has either received a complaint about the individual in question, the individual whose records are sought, or has probable cause to believe that individual has been subject to abuse or neglect. Applying that requirement to this case, the court concluded that DRW was not entitled to disclosure because it hadn't identified any individual whose records it sought. DRW now contends that the individuals in question, even if not identified, are identifiable because DPI knows who they are and contends that any probable cause regarding those individuals is contained in DPI's own investigation. Now, DPI does not deny that it does know who these individual students are, but it does deny that the information contained in its investigation constitutes probable cause to suspect abuse or neglect of those individuals. There were only 4 students, not 6, who were placed in the room in question who are mentioned in the file. There were 5 unidentified students. 2 were placed in a different seclusion room about which there have been no allegations or expressions of concern. 4 students.
I have to say, the whole idea of these exclusion rooms strikes me as shocking. The thought that that's not at least probable cause, which isn't, after all, a finding that there's ultimately a problem. It's an intermediate kind of finding. Once you know that there are particular students who were there and that that's the circumstance, why isn't that enough?
Well, I think DRW's position is that the mere use of a timeout room is per se probable cause to suspect abuse or neglect.
Locking in a room?
Now, locking, there was one student who on one occasion, who is already a client of DRW and all information about that student has been released, one student on one occasion who was placed in that room by a teacher before the light was turned on, put in, door was closed and locked. Teacher then went and found the light switch and turned it on. Student was unsupervised while the teacher went and turned on the light. I'm not here to defend that action in any way. I'm saying that is the one episode of a student being locked and unsupervised in a dark room, and all information about that student has been disclosed. The other 3 students who were placed in that, who were in the room that DPI investigated during the time period that DPI investigated, are designated in the record as students A, B, and C, and there is no evidence that any of them were ever put in under comparable circumstances. There was one possible time when the room may have been locked when A was in it, but there's no evidence that A was ever unsupervised. And all the times when B and C, with a total of 3 or 4 times for B and C, they were always the room was always unlocked and they were supervised. So our position is that there's simply no probable cause of abuse or neglect for the individuals in question. And close examination
argues, though, that it's not the state's prerogative to discern probable cause, that's for the P&A agency, that the state can't say we're trumping your determination.
I think that when the statute says that the records must be disclosed where there is probable cause, that has to mean something. It cannot mean that simply anything that a P&A agency says is probable cause is, or the statute would be entirely would be entirely meaningless. Time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Bellabia. How much time does Mr. Spitzer Resnick have? So you have 4 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to address some of the issues that came out from Appellee, including some of the questions the court raised. Specifically, I'd like to direct your attention to the PAMI regulations, which include a number of important provisions. Number one, the definition of records that a P&A agency can get include information, and I'm quoting here, and individual records, whether written or in another medium, draft or final, including handwritten notes, electronic files, photographs, or video or audio tape records. These should all be made available to the P&A. In addition, further down in that same regulation, we look at the reports from the agency, and it includes reports and records.
Could you tell us which regulation you're quoting from?
I'm sorry. This is the PAMI regulation, and let me get you. It's 45 CFR 50, Section 51.2. And excuse me, 51.41C.
Thank you.
And then the report section is in C2. Now, it's also interesting to note in the DD Act regulations, it's something that has been completely missed by the court and by DPI. It's in 45 CFR 1386.22. all the letters and numbers right here. G, excuse me, little I. If a system is denied its request, as we were here, two things need to be happen. We need to be notified of the reason. We were notified of the reason. Okay. But in addition, we must be provided with the names of the students' legal representatives. So we're not just talking about FERPA here, not just talking about directory information. To the extent, and there's lots of argument by the amicus briefs, by the parties, about can you mesh these laws? Here it is, right here. You can mesh the laws. At a very minimum, you got to provide them with the parents' information. And frankly, when we asked for the kid's name, we would have then, of course, gone to the phone book, found out who their parents were, and contacted the parents. We're not going to go interview these young children with disabilities on their own. They don't have legal authority to move on their own anyway. Now, a few other things that came up. To the extent that FERPA requires at all an issue of, gee, this is a confidential information, what do? FERPA clearly requires the court to do a balancing test. District court didn't do it. Period, end of story. We can't even comment on whether or not the balancing test was done correctly because it simply wasn't done. Now, one of the most important reasons it wasn't done, of course, and one of the reasons there's so many questions about these mysterious notes is DPI is the only one who knows what they say. We don't know what they say. The district court doesn't know what they say. You don't know what they say. And that's not what the P&A locks or FERPA, including FERPA, require. Because if FERPA is the law that we should be looking at, and we don't concede that it is, I mean, obviously you have to take it into consideration, but we don't think it's the trumping law, if you will. But even if it is, doesn't the district court have to at least look at these things and say, gee, how much confidentiality am I weighing here? Maybe it's trivial. Maybe it's not. DPI says these kids weren't locked at all. Maybe it's not so important for us to get it. The district court can't opine about that. The district court thinks there's no individuals involved. Of course there are individuals involved. There are five specific individuals involved. Maybe some of them were locked. Maybe they weren't. Remember, we didn't just get probable cause from DPI's report. We initially got a complaint from another parent in October of 2004, and then we saw the videos by the TV news before it was broadcast, were asked to comment on it, and most particularly, and this is where it gets really troubling about, is everybody telling the truth here and the need for us to investigate the investigation, is the superintendent of schools saying on camera, gee, sometimes it doesn't matter. This is not a quote, but this is a paraphrase. We can't let these kids run around willy-nilly as to is it okay to violate fire codes. The principal of the school building attempts to tell the reporter that we don't have a room like this. Now, when you're investigating public officials who are overtly lying on camera, you need to go deeply. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counselor. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.